Good morning. I hope you're having a fine Sunday morning. Welcome back to another edition of Miami Valley Voices on this Cox radio station. As usual, I'm your host from the Dayton Daily News, Ron Rollins. And I am in the studio with a couple of return guests from the Dayton Art Institute, who we've had in the studio the last couple of times. There's been a new visiting special exhibition, and there is one there now. We're going to talk about it with Amy Marcio de Gallen, the chief curator. How are you doing this morning?
Good morning, Ron.
I'm glad you're back.
Glad to be here.
And Eric Brockman, who's the marketing and communications manager at the Dayton Art Institute. So welcome back.
Good morning,
back. Ron. Good morning. So the show that's up now is Call to Duty, and it's a very cool collection of war posters from World War I and World War II, which are amazing works of art in their own right. So why this? Why now? And talk about what people can see.
Sure. We are within the 100-year time span of the anniversary of World War I.
Correct.
And we're also on the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. And so we thought it'd be a great moment. We saw this exhibition touring around, and we thought we would bring it to Dayton, Ohio. We also thought it would be a great opportunity to partner with our neighbors at the Air Force Museum.
Oh, true. Right.
And so the combination of all these things coming together, we thought it was the right time and the right moment to bring this work to Dayton.
And it opened July 4th weekend? Right?
It did.
And it's going until
October 4th.
October 4th. Cool. So people have plenty of time to go. So it is a mixture of posters, most all American posters, or are there British
are
posters as well in there?
Right. Some from our allied countries.
Yeah, so yeah.
French, Belgian.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, Britain.
And so it starts off, and it's a real mixture of, it's like war bonds, buying war bonds, home front support
right.
the troops. There's a lot of stuff that's just kind of overt propaganda, especially the ones from World War I. Talk a little bit about the artistic styles and the range and how you approached them as the curator.
Sure. You know, the show is organized around themes, so you won't start out, it's not chronological. You don't see all World War I first and then World War II.
Right.
And I think the organization around themes really is helpful because you see the repetition of the themes from World War I to World War II. You see some of the stylistic changes. You also see, it's just really such a great time capsule moment to look back at American history and see what some of the important things were and how we approached our relations with women and men and children and responding to these issues. I think artistically, many of these artists that were illustrating these posters were major artists of the day. So Norman Rockwell, was probably the most well-known. Howard Chandler Christie, James Montgomery Flagg.
Who was an Ohio guy, right?
Yeah, a lot of these, actually a lot of them have Ohio roots, which is interesting.
I think Flagg was from Zanesville or something like that.
Yeah. And I think something that, too.
And so people know that's the famous I Want You Uncle Sam poster that people have so that goes back, that's a World War I poster, right?
It's a World War I, and it was actually modeled after a British poster from a couple of years before them, 1914.
Mm-hmm.
But it became such a popular image for Flagg that it was updated for World War II.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't think I knew that.
Yeah. And so you see it in both World Wars.
That's cool. So how many, it's a large exhibition. How many pieces?
84 original posters in the exhibition.
And where are they from? All single source or gathered from all over? Or?
It's from the Reading Museum in Reading, Pennsylvania.
Who loaned us the Impressionist show the last time you guys were here to visit with us, right?
Right.
So remind people of that show right quick.
That was an exhibition that was American Impressionism, and many of those artists, it was based on the artist colonies along both coasts, many of which were East Coast, but there were a little bit, the show included things from the West Coast as well. But the posters, because they're also from Reading, PA, a lot of these posters were actually used. So if you're coming to see the show, you'll see creases down the middle in some of them.
Mm-hmm.
They were folded up and mailed to supermarkets and churches, and on some of them there are stamps on the bottom that say where they went. So 7th Ave and PA. And so they were really the posters that people saw to get the messages about the war.
Are posters a more rare or harder to preserve kind of artwork? I mean, because they weren't made to last. But these are in mostly pretty good shape. I think most people's exposure to this kind of stuff is probably Antiques Roadshow, where, the posters are like, wow. It's, and they always talk about, how well preserved or not it is. Are these hard to find and keep because they were just printed to throw away or?
Yeah, I mean, I think these are in great shape. Mm. And anybody who has posters, I mean, you try to keep them out of the light. Ideally, you would only exhibit a work on paper for 3 months and then rest it for a period of time. Mm. You want to make sure that colors are fresh still. So these are really fresh. They aren't light struck. That's the term we use to suggest that the colors have faded or suffered from being in the light too much.
What led to Reading pursuing this avenue of collection?
You know, it's a great question. They have such an eclectic collection.
They really seem to, yeah.
They have a fine art collection, and then they have the ephemera and ethnographic collection. Mm-hmm.
Now, how did the relationship between them and the Dayton Art Institute get started? I can't remember the last time there were two back-to-back exhibitions of this kind of quality from the same institution.
I know. They put together these package shows, and when we borrowed the Impressionist exhibition from them, I asked them, you know, what else did they have in the pipeline? And they mentioned this show, and I thought, you know, that's actually interesting. Let's think about that.
Especially in a military town, yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So how did the partnership with the Air Force Museum, I'm sorry, the National Museum of the Air Force, I've got to get that right. what did they contribute to the mix?
They contributed expertise, for mm-hmm. one. So their archivist, Christina Douglas, who's coming to speak at some point during the run of the show.
Oh, okay, good.
Let's see, August 20th, she's giving a talk.
All right.
So she's their archivist, and we worked with several folks down at the museum. Marketing worked with them as well. Mm-hmm. But we borrowed a lot of objects. So we borrowed a trench knife to talk about trench warfare. Mm-hmm. We really were trying to get...
It's an ugly thing, too.
It is.
It really is.
It's deadly. Trying to kind of get a dose of reality. I mean, the propaganda posters are lifting you up and getting you into the spirit of the war and mm-hmm. supporting the troops. We really wanted to bring it back to earth and have some items that related to close to home. Mm-hmm. So we've got things from Captain Eddie Rickenbacker, who was a Columbus native.
From Ohio,
World War I
guy, that's right.
Flying ace. We have a digitized...
He was the World War I flying ace from the United States, right.
We have his digitized journal.
Oh.
And he talks about designing the wing insignia, that's the Grim, or the Uncle Sam hat.
It's the hat through the ring, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
And we have the original insignia from his plane and others from the 13th Squadron.
I was geeky about that stuff like in fifth or sixth grade, yeah. And there was a book I read, I remember the title was Canvas Falcons. It was like a book I read about the air war in World War I when I was, like I said, fifth grade, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of thing that sticks with you, you know, and Rickenbacker was quite a guy. And so
I know.
So and there is another, but you started to mention the Grim Reaper one. There is more canvas art in the exhibition
there
near the
is.
Back. Yeah.
So we've got Rickenbacker's plane insignia, mm-hmm. the 13th Aero Squadron has the Grim Reaper, mm-hmm. we've got theirs. We've got a POW journal that's filled with drawings. Mm-hmm. There's a Mercury figure that's a canvas war plane insignia, mm-hmm. and a tiger. So it's just think really neat to see
that, yeah.
these hand-painted insignias that were on the planes. And of course they were destroyed after the war.
Sure.
And then they cut out that part, and then that's what the Air Force
And now that kind of evolved into the so-called nose art in World War II, right? Which tended toward the cartoon characters, scantily clad women,
yes.
things like that. A lot of which you can see at the Air Force Museum, yeah.
And they've got a whole display of that. I think, and Disney got involved too. And
right.
so they've got a Disney display up right now that talks about that.
Your point about Disney is interesting. So there was a complete involvement between the society at home, culture at home, and what was going on overseas, mm-hmm. and that's really reflected in the posters. Like, mm-hmm. there's at least one that talks about involving Girl Scouts and collecting, doing something at the on the home front. There's a lot of that. Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts
and the YWCA
and stuff like that. I mean, it looks like all these
Salvation Army Lassie,
right? Organizations were pulled into the propaganda mix.
They were, and I think I was really surprised by that. I just assumed they were all government issued mm-hmm. Posters. So two surprises really for me. That is one of them. All of the support levels from all the service organizations. And then the second surprise really was how every citizen was a soldier. Every mm-hmm. citizen was impacted or direct. These posters addressed them. So mm-hmm. from children on up to adults, not just men of enlistment age, but everybody had to do their part, and there was a role for them.
Right, especially in World War II.
Especially in World War II.
Yeah, which went on much, much longer, you know, but and was involved more of everything. But I was surprised also, too, by the brutality of some of the imagery. I mean, it's not an uneasy show to look at,
right,
anything like that. But when you're looking at a lot of the imagery, a lot of it is fairly savage. Maybe
it
not
is.
By what we're used to today in movies and stuff and TV, but I think for the time it probably was. It's more savage than I think I would see in the other artwork of the day, mm-hmm, that you would say find on a magazine cover or something.
And I think that's a really good point. I mean, all the World War One, and for the most part, World War Two, people didn't have access to TV, mm-hmm, and it was through radio. So you didn't have any imagery that was accompanying what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, these artists were really providing the window into that world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, being propaganda posters, they were really trying to get you on the side of, you know, we're fighting these enemies.
Right.
Look how savage they are.
Look how bad they are, yeah.
And it was, you know, some of it is tough material. It's very jingoist material,
and somewhat racist too. I mean, in the depictions of the Japanese, especially,
for sure.
Yeah, which I thought also was interesting because, like, today, even though, well, for example, use our fight with ISIS, for example. I mean, the society and government does its very best to make the point that we're fighting this force, but we're trying not to demonize or criminalize their faith or their nationality. And there's like a real social thing around that in the way we regard this today.
Mm-hmm.
That stuff was just not happening back then. Right. I mean, they were like, Japanese are and Germans are bad people, and we're out to eliminate them, almost like a disease. It's very obvious in the propaganda, and I think people will be struck by the difference. It's,
mm-hmm,
really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of knew it, but I was surprised by just how much in your face it is.
I was surprised by it too. Some of them really hit me hard,
because
I just thought, wow, this is just really, clearly they were trying to get you to see them in only one way.
Subhuman.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bestial. Yeah.
Right. And do you think they worked? Do you have a sense of, I mean, just on a visceral level?
You know, yes and no.
We won and all that, but I mean, do you think these posters had an impact?
You know, one of my favorite posters in the exhibition is the he's watching you, the helmet over the dark eyes.
Right, right.
But I discovered that was not a successful poster.
Interesting.
And so until World War II, they didn't have any kind of way of measuring the success of these posters,
mm-hmm,
but then they formed this Office of War Information Act that really registered, is it a successful image? Do people get it?
Interesting.
And that particular poster, people thought was a Liberty Bell instead of the Stalag helmet with the bolts on the side.
Right.
They thought it was a Liberty Bell, or they thought it was corporate America saying, get back to work.
Okay.
He is corporate America.
Yeah, I'm looking at a picture of it now, yeah.
But I think they were effective because, again, this is such a different time, pre-TV. This was the source of information,
mm-hmm,
for the most part, visual information. It was pre-refrigeration, so people had to go out to the supermarket almost every day.
Right.
So they encountered these posters everywhere they went.
Right.
And I think that they couldn't help but be influenced and impacted by them.
Yeah. Yeah. Eric, thoughts from you on what struck you most about the images that you were seeing?
Pretty much like you were saying, just the kind of the nature of, you know, the sorts of things and the way they would convey the messages. You know, I think tying into that, really the way a lot of everything beyond the posters in society, some of these portrayals vilifying the enemy. I mean, even the Bugs Bunny cartoons of the era,
mm-hmm,
were very propaganda-ish, and you rarely see those anymore because of that. That
they were kind of nasty.
They were mean.
Yeah.
And you know, one real interesting comparison Christina Douglas from the Air Force Museum made, relating to the pre-TV era and pre-internet and all of that, that in some ways these posters were kind of like the internet memes we have today.
That's a very good comparison.
That She actually compared some of the Remember 9/11 memes with some of the Remember Pearl Harbor posters that are in the exhibit, and the imagery is actually very similar. The tattered flag and Never Forget and sorts of things like that that, you know, hadn't really fully occurred to me till I stopped and thought about it. And, you know, that's, you know, it's in some ways it's very different, but in some ways it's not all pretty, that pretty different. Similar,
That's a very good point. Somehow during World War One, though, they missed out on the crying eagle. Okay, I know I'm going to feel bad about that. Let me tell people what they're listening to. If you're just tuning in, this is Miami Valley Voices on this Cox radio station. I'm Ron Rollins, your host, and I'm here with Eric Brockman and Amy Marcero DeGallen from the Dayton Art Institute, and we are talking about Call to Duty, a splendid exhibition of World War One and World War Two propaganda posters. Very artful. 84 of them down at the Art Institute through October 4th. There's also a sideshow to the, not a sideshow, like a side exhibition as part of this that involves much different work from the posters. Mm-hmm. Talk about that a little bit. It's really beautiful.
It is. It's a really kind of sobering and somber, kind of thoughtful body of work by a Cincinnati-based photographer, Jane Alden Stevens. Mm-hmm. And it's called Tears of Stone, World War One Remembered. Mm-hmm. We really wanted to end the show on a contemplative note, and so this body of work just really provides
I'd say you
that.
Did, yeah, right.
They're really powerful large format photographs. We've got about 20 of them, and she spent...
And by large format, they're large.
They're large.
They're like 4.5, 5 feet across. I mean,
yeah.
They're huge photos.
Most of them are five, they're 60 inches.
Yeah.
But many of them were taken with a pinhole camera, and so she's really literally very close within inches of the subject and taking it and then getting it this large...
So describe some of the subject matter. She was in cemeteries and war cemeteries in Europe, right?
She spent 2 years and made 5 trips to Europe and photographed cemeteries and battlegrounds on which some of the bloodiest battles were waged from World War One. Mm-hmm. And she's really was thinking about landscape as memory and having and holding all of this memory from the past. Mm-hmm. And they're black and white, and they're just really powerful.
Well, they're beautiful. I mean, they have the kind of contemplative, quiet power that you were talking about, but they're just beautiful images.
And it's not just the photographs. She really sees it as a conceptual installation, because part of what she did is that she photographed the pages of the memorial books from these cemeteries, reproduced them in little 5x7 cards, and we have a label ledge all the way around the space,
right.
And visitors are encouraged to write their own memories and place them in front of the photographs, and that's her idea.
Neat. That's a very neat idea.
And it's just
have people been doing it? I was there opening. No,
yeah,
I haven't been back in
a lot of cards.
A lot of
out
cards.
Already.
And it's surprising. I've read a few, and many of them are talking about peace. Many of them have very, very powerful messages and memorials to loved ones that they've lost.
Oh, that's interesting.
And there are a few people have actually left the room and had to come back because it's just too emotional.
That's interesting. Yeah, it's kind of jarring, actually, the difference between the posters and then these, because I mean the posters are very bright, vivid kind of images, and then these are softer and quieter. They really pull you. You get the posters from across the room. I mean, you don't. They're made to be seen from across the room. And these photos, even though they're larger than the posters by twice, they are definitely. They want you to come up close and inspect them. It's really an interesting contrast.
All of which
I assume you planned very carefully.
Well, you know, so the posters, of course, they start out, they're in the main space. But then there is this hallway passage that kind of connects the posters to the photographs. Mm-hmm. And that's where the bulk of the items from the Air Force Museum are. And we borrow from the Red Cross, too, and those items are there also to kind of act as the transition space to get from the very uplifting propagandistic posters to the more contemplative material.
Now tell me a little bit about the artist. Give us her name again.
Jane Alden Stevens.
Okay.
And she was, she's recently retired faculty from the University of Cincinnati.
Okay.
And it's just a great body. In fact, she's coming to speak at the museum September 17th.
Okay.
It's a Thursday evening talk.
Okay.
There's a catalog that accompanies the exhibition, and she'll be available to sign copies.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
What other kind of work does she do? Is this typical of her work?
I don't know a lot of her other work.
Yeah.
I knew about this body. A colleague from the University of Cincinnati shared the work with me some time ago, and I kind of had her in my file as someone to think about.
Talk about that a little bit, just maybe sort of, and we'll get back to this particular exhibit, but talk a little bit about those kind of associations that kind of happen and cause a show to just, I mean, like I said, you had somebody in your files, this other show drives up. I mean, your job sort of is about adjacencies in a lot of ways, isn't it? I mean,
exactly.
Talk about how that process works.
So, you know,
or doesn't, maybe sometimes.
We have, you know, the full space is about 7,200 square feet. Mm-hmm. Many of the shows are 5,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. And I'm always looking for what can we combine with something else. So we might not get a show that fills the entire space. What can we combine? What makes it interesting? What's a good complement or a companion? Or what, I guess really my goal, I never want something to be sort of a monolithic experience. I want someone to really come away with questions more than answers maybe, and want to look at other points of connection to our permanent collection. Mm-hmm. So a lot of times I'll get proposals and I think, okay, well, this is really interesting, but it's not enough to fill the entire space. And so I'll just put it in my file and I'll keep it in mind if something else that comes along and we can build something around it.
How often is it a happy accident? I mean, like wow, this is great. This will be
really good. This is kind of what happened with this exhibition. Really? I mean, it really was. And I think those are the best kind.
Oh, yeah. That's very cool. What is coming next? My guess is we'll get back to the posters in a moment. But there's another. This is one in a theme in a series this year of American themed exhibitions.
Right. So the last American exhibition this year is Grandma Moses.
Yay! We love Grandma Moses.
You can't get more American than that.
You really
can't.
All American
Grandma Moses, and that's really taking a different look at her work through the lens of handicraft. And I think. You know, I think people think of her as this homespun Americana.
Oh, I know they do.
But, you know, I think what we're hoping to do with this exhibition is start people out giving her backstory that she came out of that tradition very much with handicraft and look at her work through that lens, but also point the way, because she really was a modern artist. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you look at her work, it really does dissolve into pattern and form, and wasn't that what so many other modern artists were doing? Mm-hmm. Her contemporaries. And so people really, I'm hoping to make people change some of their assumptions about her work. Mm-hmm. And nobody's really looked at her work in this way. We're showing a large body of her early, what they call crewel work, which is these embroidered pieces.
Mm-hmm. Are they literally embroidered or painted to look
They're
like
embroidered.
Those? Okay.
They're embroidered. So that's what she did more or less until her late 70s, handiwork. Mm-hmm. She did quilts. She made dresses for her granddaughters and really kind of came out of that handwork tradition. And yet the way she was doing it was different than what a traditional American handiworker would have done in a sampler. So we're getting a body of early American samplers to kind of compare and contrast.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah.
And looking at some crazy quilts. And I think it'll be a really interesting show. I hope it'll be a really interesting show.
And you're doing the curation of this show yourself, right?
Right. So this is an exhibition that we are originally organizing ourselves.
Will it move on somewhere else? Or
no. And, you know, I think that's actually come up. A number of people have heard that we're doing this and are really interested in the idea of it moving on.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of loans from private places that would be difficult.
I assume that's pretty complicated. And actually, we'll have you back in September, right, to talk about this?
Hopefully.
Or not September.
No,
September.
November. The show
November.
Opens
this
in
is
November.
Open. The posters are up till October 4th, as you said. Yeah, okay, cool.
November. Although we're certainly happy to come back in September and talk about Oktoberfest.
So. I'll leave that one to you.
Get that one in
We
there.
Have about 4 minutes left. Let's talk about Oktoberfest. Yeah, so actually, Oktoberfest is last weekend of September,
right? 25th
what else,
through
what
the 27th.
What else is going on at the Artist?
Well, we've always got a lot of different programs going on. The beginning of August, the Ruby Girls are coming back to the DAI. They did a sold-out show there a couple years ago in 2013.
So that's August 1st.
Yeah, doing a 30th anniversary
show. That's amazing.
Show.
Those guys
They've
have been around for 30
years.
Wow.
People love them. They're tremendously popular.
I was just talking with Josh Stuckey, one of the Ruby Girl founders, the other day. And he reminded me of that number, and I 30 years.
Yeah,
doing anything for 30 years is like pretty good.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Most arts groups, which is what they are, they're an arts troupe, you know, don't last that long. Not without a few dramatic breakups and a reunion tour.
You know? Yeah, you know, outside of the Rolling Stones, you know,
that's true.
Hangs around that long.
That's true.
So they'll do a show in the auditorium.
That's going to sell out, I assume.
Yeah, we expect it to. Yeah. And then an after party in the Gothic cloister there.
And people should remember all the money that they raised goes to AIDS research.
Yeah. It's their benefit shows. They've raised a tremendous amount of money over the years. Mm-hmm. So it's for a good time and for a good cause.
Yeah.
So we've also got our Vine and Canvas wine tasting series keeps coming along.
Now that sounds tasty. What is it actually?
Well, actually, the next one is a beer tasting, our first beer tasting. So it's kind of hops, vine, and canvas, I guess you could say, on July 30th, tying into the poster exhibition.
At 6:30 p.m.
Sampling beers by a company called American Pride, and there'll also be a tour of the War Posters exhibition as part of that on July 30th. Mm-hmm. We've got our jazz series starts back up. The second half of the series begins on August 13th with a jazz organist from Columbus, Linda Dactyl, who she plays a lot with Tony Monaco and those guys over in Columbus. So that first time we've had her on the series. So, you know, folks who like jazz organ, that's going to be not to miss show.
So it's all on the website.
Yeah, DaytonArtInstitute.org.
And of course, you guys just got done. Well, I say just. I mean, about 6 weeks ago, wrapping up a fabulous art ball.
Over 900 people.
Oh, really?
Yep.
I told your buddy Alexis Larson, who runs that event and is a former coworker here of mine at Cox, that was the best art ball that I've been to. I've been to about a dozen of them. That was the best. Yeah, easily.
It was a good one.
It was a good one. And we're just going to leave that sit there and let people imagine. It's basically, if you haven't been to the Art Ball, it's prom night for adults. It's like one of the top social dues in town. Ladies in their lovelies and men in their tuxes, and everybody has a good time.
And it's one of our largest fundraisers.
I would imagine.
It's also, for a good cause.
Today,
yeah.
Right?
Oktoberfest is the biggest, followed by Art Ball. So those are vital to everything.
It was the second weekend in June, I think? Yeah.
Yes. Second Saturday in June.
Always a fine time. I was glad I got to go this year. We had missed the last few. We got about a minute left. So, Amy, what do you want people to take away from the poster show? What do you hope they'll leave with?
You know, I think that I think that it provides an important portal into history. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we don't learn from some of our past, we will repeat them in the present. I think that was a quote that you had provided for something.
Yeah.
And I just think that they're really fun on one level, but they're really powerful and to think about and to look at and reinvestigate.
Do you have a favorite? There's a lot to choose.
Well, I love that he's watching you, Poster.
Yeah, it's
really
very surreal.
It's kind of
ghoulish.
Yeah.
I just love the artistic styles were just fabulous back then. It's a really great way to go back and see what was popularly being.
Well, the color palettes are so strong and bold, and some of the new colors and the strong diagonal graphics and.
That's fabulous.
They're great.
We're out of time. Thanks for coming in. We will have you guys back in, if not to talk about Oktoberfest, we will definitely get you back in the late fall for the Grandma Moses show, because these are fun. I always look forward to having you guys back in. So we've had Amy DeGallen and Eric Brockman from the Dayton Art Institute talking about Call to Duty, the big, fabulous show of World War I and II propaganda posters at the Dayton Art Institute through October 4th. Thanks again. Appreciate
you
coming
in. Thanks so much, Ron.
You betcha. This has been Miami Valley Voices. We'll see you next week.